I don't just bring this stuff up because I care about you having money. That's not really even the main point. If you find yourself in one of these financial emergencies and you don't take the drastic steps that we're going to recommend, the impact is across all five capitals.
Run your home and your dough like a biblical boss.
Top of the morning to you, Stephen. How's the voice?
You might be able to pick up from the way that I speak that there have been some illnesses that have made their way through my home. I know that's true for you too. How's it going over there?
We're mostly recovered. I told my wife yesterday. I've even resorted to things like looking into the benefits of marshmallow root to deal with the persistent cough.
You have the persistent cough like me.
Yeah, well, mine, I mean, it's been a solid 4 weeks since I was actually ill, but I'll still go through some fits. So I have a lot of sympathy for where you are based on what I hear through your microphone today.
Okay, what in the world is a marshmallow root? Are you going to start rubbing oregano oil on your children's feet?
No, this is how I know our phones are always listening, even to our medical conditions, because it hears me cough. And then the next thing you know, I open up Apple and it says, explore the benefits of marshmallow root for addressing persistent cough.
You've got to be kidding.
And did I click it? Of course I clicked it because I was interested. And it said that it only lasts for like 15 or 20 minutes. So not long enough to get through an episode of Abraham's Wallet, which is why I have my desk side bag of the disgusting Halls relief drop.
Do you find the Halls to be the most effective cough drop? Because I'm always a Ricola guy.
See, I think Ricola tastes, they're not disgusting enough to work.
Oh, I see.
Halls is truly revolting because they're full of the menthol.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm so fired up about this one that I've got to just jump in, Stephen.
Okay. Tell us how did the bee get under your bonnet? How did you say we're going to spend a day talking about being in the financial emergency zone?
Yeah. I'm going to tell you some stories that are all either actual individual people's stories, or in every single story I'm going to tell, it's not one person. So people that listen probably know I'm a financial planner. I talk to families in all sorts of scenarios. Some of them are just dealing with massive piles of multi-generational wealth. Other people they have their little backpacking shovel out and they're trying to dig out of a bad situation, and everything in between. And so I hear all of these things. And lately, I've been hearing more and more situations where people waited until it was way, way too late to realize the pickle they had arrived in. And so what I want to do today is help you, the listener, understand when and how to declare financial emergency.
Oh.
I want to tell you a quick story.
Now, wait. Are you also going to tell us if you're in a financial emergency, you should do this and this?
We're going to figure out, am I in one? And if I am, what do I do?
And then if you've reached this point, you're no longer in a financial emergency.
And I'm even going to tell you how people go back and forth on this and how to make sure you don't get out of it just to fall back into it. You know,
oh, I love it. Solve this problem. Do you think this is a problem that many Americans have?
I think everybody will brush closer than they think.
Okay.
To financial emergency at some point in their life. So if you're hearing this and you're going, I'm 24 and I just never had a situation like that, there's a good chance that this is still going to be relevant to you, because you don't have to fall into the pit to go, oh, we are a little closer to the edge of the chasm here than I realized. It's a good thing to know where it is. I just want you to all know where it is, because most people realize the location of the pit when they have already fallen about 15 feet down the bottom.
Okay, good.
Listeners will remember that I used to do really, really long running races. And Stephen, you've even done one of those with me, right?
God forgive you. Yes.
Yeah. And one of the things about running really long distances, especially if you're a little bit, so when I was a kid, my mom bought the Husky fit jeans for me.
Yeah, so, I might have had some Husky jeans.
I'm not a thin-boned, lightweight runner by design.
Uh-huh.
And so when I decided, okay, I'm going to start training, I'm going to do 100 miles of running a week to train for these ultra marathons. I went and I dang broke my foot. I had a stress fracture in my foot.
Okay.
And I was very bummed about this because the healing process is basically don't use your foot, so stay off of it. But in that process, I was icing it a lot. And lo and behold, because I was messing with this foot, looking at it, I noticed I had a new mole. I had a little mole on the inside of one of my toes, between my toes. I would never have noticed that mole if I hadn't been icing this foot. But I thought, you're supposed to sound an alarm, right? When you have a mole that you didn't have. And so I thought, this looks like a mole to me, but whatever. My wife is friends with our dermatologist. So she took a picture of this mole and sent it to the dermatologist. And the dermatologist did not think this looked like a regular old mole. And lo and behold, shortly thereafter, I was in the office. She was biopsying it. She's like, we should just rule out anything bad. She calls me back and says, we did not rule out anything bad. We ruled it in. And you're going to need a surgical procedure. They're going to go all the way down to the bone on that toe. And blah, blah, blah. Long story short, I had that thing removed. And it was the type of thing that they said, look, thank God you caught this. Because we've got it. No problems going forward. But if you had waited just a little longer, you might have lost your whole toe. Might have died. This is the type of spot that appears that, if left unattended, disfigures and kills people.
Okay, okay.
And so I thought, wow, I had no idea. And the reason that I'm opening with that is because I think there's a lot of financial situations that people fall into where they go, yeah, I mean, I should get this checked up maybe,
right.
But it's not a big deal. It's just a little spot on my financial record. And so I'm going to give you four scenarios to just illustrate what I mean. Scenario number one, you lost your job, but you're not an idiot. You had a 6-month emergency fund. Good job. You've got expenses saved. And you've been a high demand kind of guy for your whole career. So you're not worried. Spending goes on as usual. You've got 6 months to go find a new job. And after about 3 months, you're still looking for a job. But I've still got 3 months. And then we've only got 1 month of emergency fund left. And I'm still looking for a job. Can I tap into my retirement accounts? What do I do here? Common scenario, even though we're not talking about some jack wagon who ran off and bought us something they couldn't afford or whatever. This is a common scenario. So that person is very close to disaster and needs to be declaring financial emergency.
Oh, they can see the financial emergency zone from where they are.
They're in it.
Oh.
And they let themselves get boiled in the pot like the frog because they thought, well, I'm protected. I'm fine. Okay. Number two, you've gone through your financial planning process here with Mark Parrott, and you have a budget that he says, that budget looks great. It jives with the plan we've made. That spending looks great. But when you sent it to him, you knew that you don't actually track your spending. And it was probably an optimistic estimate of how much you spend on stuff.
I'm going to guess that happens quite a bit.
Yeah, of course. And so you've had a couple unexpected expenses come up. You know, it was Christmas and a busy season where it was just easier to get takeout every night instead of make food at home. And you wake up and you notice there's a $5,000 balance on your credit card. Oops. And you haven't paid it in a couple months. and you just started working on a long-term financial plan, so you actually don't have an emergency fund or any assets other than your 401k at work. You are in a financial emergency. It's time to declare financial emergency.
Wow.
Okay, scenario three, totally different. You make a boatload of money compared to where you were 3 years ago.
Uh-huh.
A new job, let's say, has just totally shifted your financial reality. And before, you actually had to budget or you'd run out. So you had to budget, but you don't have to budget anymore. And you even went out and you bought some new assets when you got this job. You know, it was time to finally get that fancy car or a vacation home. And you don't worry too much about all this spending because, man, your prospects, the star is bright now, but the future is even brighter.
Yeah.
You are very close to financial emergency.
Ooh.
Okay.
That's a hot take right there.
And lastly, you got a late start financially. Let's say you didn't start saving until you were in your 50s. But you've got a solid plan now. And as long as you can work until you're 67 or so, which seems reasonable, you're super healthy, then you can catch up enough to fund your needs for the long term. But then you get a call and it's bad news. There's something that the doctor has to say to you that is not happy.
You get some toe news.
Well, you get the yeah, you're in a financial emergency now. The thing you counted on to provide for your future, which was another 15 or 20 years of work, may be impossible. So these are all people that are either in or right on the edge of financial disaster. And my guess is a lot of them have no idea how close they are.
Okay, great.
So I think one of the most common ones that I want to kind of focus in on is it kind of pops into a lot of these, which is it could be the high income person who doesn't mind racking up real debt on things, or, you know, even if they buy their $1 million lake house in cash, that's an asset that's going to take some money to keep it functioning. Or they're spending a little extra here and there, and it's not a big purchase. It's just, a little more than we make, and it goes on the credit card and it's not that much. Or I lost my job and the emergency fund's out. Am I supposed to start running up the credit card now? What else do I do? A lot of these scenarios result in the same outcome, which is people ending up with consumer debt, credit card debt. What do you think the average credit card debt is for people who have a credit card balance in our country?
Boy, meaning, I should know this.
Meaning they don't pay it off every month. I don't expect you to know because I didn't know, but just give me a guess.
$25,000.
It's a lot less than that.
Oh, okay.
So
good.
Only $7,236 right now.
I'm delighted.
So I think that this is where it gets really problematic is people, you know, in my example, it was a $5,000 credit card debt. Well, $5,000 is not nothing, but it doesn't feel like a scary, humongous number.
It doesn't feel like a life ender.
Right. I don't owe $1 million. So what I did is I looked at this situation, said, if you just had that average American credit card debt, $7,236, and you didn't make any payments. Now, obviously, if you didn't make any payments, you're going to get hit with late penalties and it's eventually going to ruin your credit and all sorts of things.
Ooh, no.
But if we just ignore that, average interest rate on these credit cards that are have balances is
19.
Right about
19%.
Higher.
24%.
It's 20. Right at 20%. So you're close. So what would happen if we could just imagine that debt just was allowed to grow?
Not good.
Well, after 10 years.
Oh, no.
Your balance is now $50,000.
Oh, no.
That's, again, now
that's
we're talking.
That's an imposing number.
That's an imposing number. But in this day and age, you know, a Toyota SUV costs $50,000. So maybe I'm like, well, I might could handle that. Okay. After another 10 years,
oh, no.
It's $335,000.
Are you serious?
And in 7 more years, it's 1 million.
No way.
So this is the type of thing that can just run away like a train with no brakes.
27 years, starting with 7K, and it's $1 million?
Yeah. And by that time, your life is ruined.
Yeah, you're right.
And I'm going to get to that at the end, but I don't just bring this stuff up because I care about you having money. That's not really even the main point. I'm going to talk at the end of this episode about if you find yourself in one of these financial emergencies and you don't take the drastic steps that we're going to recommend, the impact is across all 5 capitals. And you don't need to be some Christian Jesus follower to acknowledge that. There's studies after studies that talk about the impact of financial stress on relational capital, physical capital. You get dumber. Like, all these things happen. So anyways, why do people get into credit card debt? The answer is pretty obvious, but they spend more than they have. They spend more than they earn. So they have negative cash flow in their household. So the path out, once you wake up and go, I have some consumer debt, I have credit card debt, you can't just start making the minimum payment. The example I gave, if you pay $145 a month, which would be the minimum payment most likely for that card with $7,200 on it, it would take 9 years to pay that debt off. And by the time you were done, you would have paid more than double the original balance in interest. But of course, that assumes that you snap your fingers and go, oh man, I won't ever add to this debt.
Right.
And we know that's
hard to turn off that faucet.
Yeah, it's not what happens. People go, well, I'll fit a $145 payment in, but I'm still eating out. I mean, right. I'm still going to send it. So,
I mean, they're still going to send it, even if they've taken a nap or if their monthly payment is high, they're still going to send it.
So obviously there's two steps here. And you can't just start making the payment and fit that into your budget. You also have to change your spending. So step one, something I said struck a chord. You're like, well, that kind of sounds like me. Step one, you just need to make more money. That'll solve your problems, right? Is that step one?
No.
Make more money. Oh, that doesn't fix this?
No. That's a great point, Mark. Tell people why that doesn't fix things.
Man, every time I talk to somebody who is in one of these situations, in different language and with different sort of excuses or whatever, it is so common. Everyone thinks the answer is make more money. And I'm telling you, that will not help you. If you live above your means at $80,000 a year, you will live above your means if you make $2 million a year.
Truer words were never said.
And so making more, you cannot out-earn your way from bad habits. And I'm going to get there at the end here, but there's sin and wickedness that is involved in a lot of these cycles too. That's a joke. Step one is not make more money. Step one, the real step one is, it's kind of obvious. It's immediately stop spending more than you're earning. Okay? So for most of the situations, I could see, hey, we're unemployed, where there is a time where, you know, if you're unemployed and it's been a few months and we're seeing that emergency fund tick down, I do have to generate income. I don't sit there and wait to start driving Uber until my emergency fund is zero. You know, there's a situation there where earning something is important. But for most of these scenarios, it's simply we're spending more than we're earning. Not rocket science, huh? I'm sorry if you thought there was going to be a secret knowledge shared today, but I think the obvious way that this is done for most people is by making a budget. The time for, hey, we're just not really budgeting people, it doesn't fit our personality, that is over. It's like looking your cancer doctor in the eye and saying, you know, chemo doesn't really match with my personal ethic. And the doctor looks back at you and goes, well, then you're going to die.
Yeah, we're not really a surgery family. That's not really the way we do things.
But I hear it over and over and over from people. And they are like, okay, Mark, thanks for the financial plan. Love it. And I go, it's all totally pretend if the spending numbers you gave me are not true. And that is just as true of families, again, who are making seven-figure incomes as it is of families who are living on average or even below average incomes. Everybody's plan is totally pretend if they aren't aware of what they're spending. And some families are just frugal and their natural inclination is to spend way less than they make.
Yeah.
So they're not in this situation, but most of us, our natural inclination is to say, well, there's money in the checking account. I've got access. I think I'm okay. This guy's telling me I need to have a budget, but that sounds like a drag.
Yeah.
So
it's so important, Mark, that when a husband and wife are having this conversation about their spending habits, I think it's so important for them to say and believe that to turn down the spending, to get the budget under control so that the numbers are in the black every month, for them to say and believe, this is the path to wealth. This is the path to prosperity. Turning down our spending and having a smaller life, it feels like we're losing. I think that's so important, as people feel like, well, didn't we lose if we don't get to go out for steaks once a week? We love to go out for steaks once a week. Oh, if we're losing that, we're living a lesser life. And it's so important to go, no, this is the road to wealth. This is a better life that we're living. And I think having that, turning that switch in your brain makes all the difference. If you are in your lean years, if you're newly married couple and you've got a baby in arms and one on the way, and you feel like, man, we are pinching to make it through, you're probably at the low end of your earning power. You're probably at the low end of your savings, etc. You must figure out how to be in the black even when you're at low tide for income as a young person. And I think back to, I guess we would have to attribute this to my fastidious mother of German heritage, that when I was living overseas as a missionary and my tax returns were $9,000 and $11,000 those 2 years, I remember saving enough to go, because I lived in Northern England, saving enough to be able to take weekend trips to Ireland and to be able to go over into France to look around and have some, you know, have a little historical enrichment. I look back on that and go, how in the world did I do that? There was nothing to live on. How did I save up money for traveling? But it was the way that I had thought from the time I was in college. I mean, I was working by the time I was 15, saving money. And in college, I would never have thought, boy, there was a threat from my parents. If you abuse this credit card, it's going to be pulled out of your hands so fast. I didn't know it at the time, but in those lean years, I was on the path to wealth. I didn't know it. But all I was doing was living below my means. Anyways, I think that's such an important point that you're making.
Yeah. So you're going to make a budget and you're going to actually have a plan to track it and to spend less than you make. Okay. That's non-negotiable for most of you that are feeling like, oh, I might be in this situation. Number two is you destroy the things that are making it impossible for that to work.
Oh.
So you cut up the credit cards.
Oh.
It's so weird to me how people who have struggled with this, Like I don't meet very many alcoholics who go, I do keep a little booze in the house. But I meet tons of people who go, man, we've had credit card issues our whole life. And then their wallet's freaking full of them. Yeah. I'm super pro credit card. I use credit cards for everything. And if it's ever an issue, I'm destroying them. No questions asked. But it's not just credit cards. Like I talked about assets. There's a guy on Twitter that I like to follow, and he sells exotic cars. And he records phone calls with people who are calling. And he put one up a couple weeks ago that was some guy had bought a Ferrari, and he calls and he's like, yeah, I need to get out of this car. I'm thinking maybe switching into something a little more affordable because I was making $40,000 a month when I bought it. And now I'm only bringing in about $10,000 a month in my business. And the guy's like, well, what do you owe on the car? He's like, well, I financed it at 100% and I paid $750,000 for the car.
Oh.
And the guy's like, I just basically need to get out of it. And the car dealer's like, it's worth $500, man. You're screwed. There's nothing that can help you. But the people are just reluctant to look reality in the face and go, yeah, we bought a vacation home. We can't afford it anymore. Even if we have to sell it and lose $100,000, we cannot allow it to bleed our family.
Right.
You know, so whatever you have to do, being willing to take whatever actions are necessary at this step one phase where we just make the cash flow statement come out in the black, do it. Okay.
Yeah.
And I think one of the steps in this phase is repenting of your sinful mismanagement.
Wow, that's a great point.
Spending more than you brought in is usually sin. And you might go, Mark, you're picking on the poor guy who got diagnosed with cancer. How can you do that? And I'm like, well, in my little scenario, he was 50 years old and he spent the first 50 years of his life choosing not to save. And missionary Stephen over here is pocketing a little money to get away on $9,000 a year. So there's usually sin, and I'm not telling you exactly what the sin is.
Right.
But this would be wise if you're in step one. Don't just run to your spreadsheet for salvation. I have to say that to myself all the time, being kind of a planning person. You also need to say, what is it that I did that was poor stewardship that landed me in a spot where this could happen?
I don't know if you made this number one, but I'm going to make it number one because that was your whole goal was you got to realize I am in the financial emergency zone and just admit that to yourself. That's number
one. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And then you said number two, start spending less and getting your budget right.
Yep.
Number three, I really like this one. Kill the thing that's killing you.
Right. And I'll put a caveat on that one because if my income went to zero tomorrow, I'm not running out and selling everything. Okay. So we have to be wise. That's why we have emergency funds. It protects the assets that we've accumulated. But this is one of those places where I would say it's so obvious to me watching from the outside that most people, I think it's like a by the time you realize it, it's too late situation, that most people will stay on a sinking ship way too long before they get in the life raft.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of those that we recognize, like we talked about health. You don't start eating healthy when your arteries are 70% clogged.
Yeah.
Like that heart attack has already been brewed. I've talked to a lot of people lately who have kind of had really emotional and tough conversations with my wife and I about child rearing, and they're describing really hard things and their kids are 17.
Woof.
And it's like, I'm not saying they're beyond the Lord's kind of transformation, but I'm not sure it's coming from you anymore. It's,
right.
But like even in investing, like the money you invest when you're 22 is worth so, so, so much more than the money you invest when you're 50.
Yes.
orders of magnitude. So you'll get a kick out of this one, Steve. I wrote this example. I'm not quite your age, but I'm getting close, right? I have yet to catch you in age, but I noticed the other day, I was like, I'm getting some lines in the face.
Oh, yeah.
And my wife goes, well, you know, there's this magical stuff that you put on your face and it'll keep you from aging there. And so I go, oh, is it expensive? No, it's not expensive. Sign me up. I'll put it on my face.
Okay.
And so I put it on my face diligently for a few weeks and I go, wife, no changes. She's like, oh, yeah. It stops you.
It stops you from getting worse.
She's like, it's not going to fix you, dude.
Yeah.
And so even things like the fact that I'm not one to sunscreen up the face before I go out for a round of golf necessarily, those choices end up catching up to you. And by the time you realize it, you know, you can maybe patch the ship, but you're not going back to 25-year-old's Mark face.
Right. Now my situation, Mark, is that I've always had a secret ambition to be old, and
yeah,
I wanted to have a leathery face with, I want to have a million wrinkles. So what can I do?
I think one thing I've noticed is the best way to get rid of wrinkles, so that you can just apply the inverse of this. The best way to get rid of wrinkles is to just get a really fat face, like always be pressing out. and so that's my plan over time, is just to really press that skin tight.
Smart. So that you just break out any of the wrinkles. That's good.
Yeah. Here's the second big phase, if you want to call it. Like, phase one was all about acknowledging the problem. And
tourniqueting the problem, staunching the flow of trouble.
I love the metaphor there, because a tourniquet is really helpful if your leg gets blown off in the battlefield. It's not a great long-term solution.
Right.
So step two, we've said, okay, we're not going to keep adding to the credit card debt. We're not going to keep compounding the problems. Now we have to take back the ground that has been lost.
Yeah.
So sometimes in step one, you had to take drastic measures. I'd say it happens. People go, I know this is going to cost me penalties and taxes and fees, but I got to take money out of my retirement plan, because otherwise this credit card train is going to run away from me. So you stopped the bleeding on the battlefield. But you could still die before the war is over, because while you can afford to pay your bills today, you're not going to be able to pay them in 15 years when you can't work anymore. So we've got to figure out a plan to replenish there. And you've also, like I talked about before, you've got to have a plan for paying back toxic debt in a timely manner. I'm not going to go into the nitty-gritty about how to repay a credit card. There's a ton of calculators. If you Google credit card repayment calculator, you'll find a ton that can help you figure out, like, what kind of payment could I make to pay this off in a reasonable amount of time with the minimum interest. And that should be a part of your budgeting process. But you can also use some tools. Like, you could consolidate debts to better terms. Like, I see a lot of people that will roll their 20% credit card into a card that has 0% interest for the first 18 months. You can do that. Beware that there's some risks. Like, you take a big happy breath and go, oh, 0% interest for 18 months. And now all of a sudden we don't feel much urgency
right.
to pay that off. And 18 months later, guess what? They don't give you that 0% interest because they
right.
think the person's great at paying off credit cards. They give you that because they're like, it goes to 27% after
right.
8 months. One thing I see people do sometimes is they make mistakes when they're restructuring debt, and they'll take short-term debt, like a car loan, and they'll say, I made a mistake. I bought this car and I'm underwater on it, and I'm, for whatever reason, I'm not willing to just take my medicine and sell it for a loss. So look, I've got this home equity line of credit over here, and it has a relatively low interest rate.
Oh no.
And it is stretched out over 30 years. So my car payment can go from $1,200 a month down to $250.
Oh,
But what they've done is they've taken short-term debt and made it very long-term. So, yes, you know, cars depreciate. They become worth less and less. Homes appreciate. We've talked about good debt and bad debt before, but that's one of the reasons we don't recommend using long-term debt for an asset that has not got long-term value. You also are, if you do something like roll your car payment into your home payment, you're turning debt that's secured against a car. So worst case scenario, you stop paying it and the repo man shows up at your door and puts your car on a tow truck. That's bad, but it's not the worst thing that could happen. I could think a lot worse thing that could happen is you stop paying on your home equity line of credit and you don't even, you don't live in that house anymore. When you stop paying that loan, it belongs to the bank. So you don't want to take debt that's secured against a small depreciating asset and put a large appreciating asset at risk for it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let me ask you a question, Mark. When people are trying to take a good hard look at consumer debt and they go, I've got to deal with this credit card and this needs to be job one and we've got to rejigger our budget, et cetera. Do you have a rule of thumb for people who, I know that one of their questions is going to be, well, okay, we got a couple in their late 20s. They're at that 7,000 credit card number. It keeps going up incrementally every month. And they go, I think we might be in the emergency zone. I think we might have to do something about this. Are you saying that they should stop all other investing with their money to be able to address this?
With credit cards, of course, the unsatisfying answer in financial planning is it always depends. But generally speaking, when there's credit card debt, I'm pointing all the guns at that.
Okay.
If you did something really, really chuckle-headed and went to one of those used car lots where they make loans for 20% interest, then it's the same as a credit card debt, right?
Like, right.
So when there's toxic debt, it needs to be killed quickly. Now, other debts like mortgages or a reasonable car payment, those we can go, well, we can work those into a long-term plan. We don't necessarily need to stop everything there. I'll just say that most people who tap into long-term assets in an emergency, whether that's their brokerage account or retirement accounts or things like that, they do struggle to get back to where they started, much less to resume building for the long term. And this can be a doorway for poverty to enter your family. It just happens that people go, well, we can trace it back to 1987 when we had to use our retirement account and we kind of just resigned ourselves to when we retire, we're just living on our Social Security after that. And that means we can't, you know, go visit the grandkids and we're on a diet of government cheese for the rest of our lives. That's why I'm warning you about this stuff. I will say there's some encouragement. Nobody's beyond fixing here. I've worked with families who have gone through this wash rinse cycle multiple times where they're like, we got out of it. And then we check in 18 months later, we're back in it. We borrowed more on our credit card and we're stuck again. And now we don't have a bailout. And I've worked with those families that have done that a few times and then eventually did figure it out. I just don't think you have to experience that pain to get it right. Like you could go, man, we thought we were in pretty good shape, but we might have some risk that we aren't aware of. And that's why I'm kind of giving you these... these indicators that aren't what Dave Ramsey will tell you. He'll say like, well, you need that $1,500 fund and then you need 3 months and then you're good. Go buy a boat. I would just say as your financial situation becomes more complex and there's maybe more assets, everything costs more to run, which means you need more of a backstop and you should be constantly checking in on that. Okay. I don't want us to walk around worried and looking to our money as if it's going to protect us. But you should be constantly checking in on, is the backstop I have against some really bad scenarios still sufficient? And that's what I want. So just to recap, phase one was acknowledge the problem and stop the bleeding. Phase two was make a plan and begin taking back the ground that was lost. And phase three, you could, you know, we talked about this even in phase one, but I want you to figure out what actually happened. So What was the cause? Was it laziness? Hey, we just didn't, we never were willing to take responsibility and pay attention. So we let little cuts eat us up until they became a big thing. Was it greed? We thought we wanted to be that family that had 15 rental homes. So we leveraged ourselves up to the eyeballs because we wanted to be rich and we got out over our skis. Was it a lack of skill? I talked to people who were like, Mark, I had a lot of money and I invested it all myself. And I heard these hot tips from my coworker and it all is nothing now. Yeah. Even just a mismatch between risk tolerance and risk capacity. I was that 65-year-old who said, hey, I want to put it all on black. Like, yeah, let's go make individual stock picks with my retirement. But you actually didn't have the ability to take that risk because that's all your money. Any of these things could be the cause. Repent of them. So just acknowledge them and turn away and say, I've been greedy. I'm not going to be greedy anymore. So I think that's a huge piece of it. Any comments on that?
Yeah, let me just encourage people about that, because you might think to yourself, what is the value of me actually saying that? Of actually stopping and saying, I was greedy. Most of us were so ashamed of the idea of doing something greedy, something as stupid and short-sighted as greed, that we want to just gloss over it. Okay, I think I learned my lesson. I don't think I'll do it. Honey, we can get through this. Let's just power up and proceed without stopping and naming it and saying, this is my sin, to at least your good buddies. You know, we built a whole study that was a financial transparency study so that you could take it to your men's small group, for instance, and just start talking about, here's our scene. And I'm going to give my friends the benefit of honesty and just go, this is us. What is the value of actually saying that, for instance, to your spouse? This was a greedy move. When I bought the boat, it was about the way that it would look. I could just imagine all of the Instagram photos we were going to take on this amazing boat. And we'd say, it's our boat. We're going to go get on our boat this weekend. Oh, well, you know, I'm having my boat worked on. I just loved all of that stuff. I loved the way that it made me feel and seem. The value of doing that is, number one, when we name sin, I'm just telling you this as a spiritual reality, you take something that's inside of you and you magically and miraculously put it outside of you. And you go, I oppose the greed that I have swallowed in the past, but I refute it now. I'm canceling that thing and I reject that thing. So that's like an important spiritual thing to say, I have agreed with this and I no longer agree with it. And to have the humility to say that in front of your wife, for instance, is powerful.
Can I also just say, I told somebody last week, I said, I want you to say this stuff to your kids.
Yes.
And it was like, he was like, what? I said, yeah, man, like you need them on your team to get to phase two, which is rebuilding. You're going to need some, you know, if your kids are old enough to understand what's going on, they're going to go, why don't we do X, Y, and Z anymore? Well, let me tell you. Also, I just think there's such a value in being willing to acknowledge sin inside our families that, you know, most of our parents probably never did that, I'd say.
Yes.
But it can be really helpful.
Amen. Which takes me to my second thing. Why is it so important to say? Because I've been teaching about this for 2 weeks at a little local church here. You stand in a river of the generations. There have been 1,000 generations that came to you in this spot, and there's going to be innumerable generations that come behind you. You're standing in a river, and there might have been a habit of greed that might be 500 years long. You don't know. And so it's so important to say out loud, we're not doing greed. We repent of it in the name of Jesus. Cleanse us of this greed for the sake of all the generations that come behind you. Like you said, Mark, you confess that to your kids and you say, we as a family, we're not doing this. So we're going to have our sensors up. Whenever greed comes calling with our family, we'll never do it because it leads to death. And you're saving your kids by saying that, for them to go, oh, we were in financial trouble because dad was greedy about a boat. And oh, we could be in a different place. Oh, note to self, you know, greed is harmful. It's so valuable for your generations.
Yeah. So if phase three is figure out what happened, obviously there's naming and repenting. But then once you have figured out what happened, like you said, Stephen, there's two things I want you to also consider doing. One is ask the question, what systems have to be in place so that I have success here in the future? I promise you that you'll repeat the cycle. Even if you get back to even, unless you take this step. So if you, you know, like I said, the alcoholic doesn't keep booze in the cabinet. The person who's lost 150 pounds doesn't leave Bluebell in the fridge. So you need to build fences. And it's not just, well, I have a really good budgeting app now. That's probably not enough, because there's probably something underneath what led to the problem. And it could be, man, we're lazy, so we need accountability. And that kind of takes me to my last piece here, which is you probably need a team that's more than just you and your wife. It could be professional help. It's certainly your community of faith. And eventually it's, I think, your family, like we said, getting kids on board makes this not the dark, shadowy place, but actually teaches them that our family is going somewhere and we're going to unearth sin as we go and chuck it out the window so that we can continue towards our destination. So having a team, I think the transparency guide is a great tool for identifying that. It's possible that you're going to take some fits and starts at this. Oh, I talked to this guy and I thought he was going to be helpful, and he turns out to be just as jacked up as me. Like, I can love him, but he's probably not my financial guide in the future. So that's kind of my phase three. The big takeaways, though, that I want you to hear. One, if you feel a little suspicious that you might be, maybe you're definitely not in the middle of financial emergency, but you might be at risk. You go, huh, yeah, I could see how we could come a little closer than we thought to that chasm. I'm telling you, you're probably much closer than you think. And the time to take action is now. It is not after half of the Titanic is underwater. And I said it at the beginning, but like the reason I care is because a financial emergency can do much more than break your money. It's a cancer that will munch your whole family up if you leave it unaddressed. And I have some statistics to prove it. 41% of divorces cite financial stress as a primary motivating factor. Couples who argue about money at least once a week have a 30% increased chance of getting a divorce. High financial stress doubles your risk of depression and anxiety. And I would say to somebody, if you're like one of these happy-go-lucky people who's like, I'm running out of money, but I'm not sweating it, man. I just trust the Lord. I would just say, just wait. Eventually, financial stress as it mounts will get you. And you will feel anxious about it. Even like pure physical stuff, financial stress doubles the annual risk of ulcers, digestive issues. It triples your risk of having a heart attack, getting migraines, or having insomnia. And if you can't sleep, there's all sorts of stuff about how that impacts your ability to complete basic intellectual tasks. Like, you might get fired. People who report being in financial stress have low academic performance in their children. Like, there's a correlation there. And being in the poverty category in the United States, which is, again, where this leads. If you have 10 grand in credit card debt and you do nothing, you're headed to poverty. And once you get there, it's a 15-year shorter lifespan in the United States if you're just in that economic category. So you might say, poverty, Mark, please, let's be reasonable. I've got an average amount of credit card debt. It's not that bad. And so hopefully I've helped you understand when and how to declare financial emergency if that's you, because this stuff you know, it's like my toe. It can be dealt with. It has to be cut out. There's some violence that has to be done to it, but it has to be cut out. And if you deal with it, you can go on and be happy and well. And if you don't, it's going to kill you. So I want you to be so willing to confront reality long, long before you get into the spot where it's a almost impossible to stop cycle.
Amen. So know where the financial emergency zone is. Know if you're getting close to it. Turn on all the sirens if you are in it. Don't deny the reality of it. And for God's sake, start to take really practical steps to reverse the process.
And you can bulk your family against this stuff even when it's not happening. Like we just finished Lodo Feb. And I think it's one of the best tools here because some of these conversations I'll have with people like, hey man, you're in financial emergency. You got to trim everything now. People will look me right in the face and go, well, $2,000 a month is as low as we can get the grocery budget. Can't get it lower. It's impossible. We have three kids. And I go, okay, let's talk. Do you want me to open my February budget for you?
Yeah, boy.
And just knowing, oh, wow, we can trim it way back. It's such a good thing to know so that yes. When maybe stuff like this happens, you like that first example, you don't wait until the emergency fund is empty. You say it's Lodo Feb as soon as dad loses his job.
Yes.
And that 6-month emergency fund, we're going to make it last 14 months.
Right.
That's totally possible. So,
right.
Yeah, there are things you can do to prepare for this even when it's not happening to you. And so that when it does happen, you're just ready to go, oh, we have that gear. Let's shift into that gear for a while we get through this storm.
That's right. Well, great wisdom, great knowledge, Mark. Thanks for sharing all that. I think it helps to bulletproof our families a lot more just to know where these danger zones are. And I even like the scenarios that you described at the beginning to know, like, what are the various ways that you could be in the emergency zone, even if you're a very high earner. So everybody, bless you this week as you are doing everything in your power. Don't give up. Don't tire of doing good. Run your home and your dough like a biblical boss.